Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne, and welcome back. We missed a week there at Christmas. It was just busier than I anticipated, as usual. And also, the book we read was impossible.
Yep, it was a little rough going.
That's okay. So before we get started, I would like to just mention a couple of emails we got. That's not the right one. Here it is.
Okay. Well, we get so many, you know.
Yeah. So we have gotten some responses about what you want us to do in the new year. Nina mentioned she liked our review of Our Favorite Thing is Monsters. And she would like to see us read a few more graphic novels, which I don't think we've mentioned yet. Or in our last episode, we were planning on reading Persepolis, both parts, for this month because we both have them. It's a little bit shorter, so it's going to be one of our mini episodes. That's by Marjane Satrapi. It's been out for quite a while. So that works out well. We'll be getting another one of those in there with graphic novel. And then I also got an email from Sarah Morrison. She told us, just wanted to drop a line with my two big book goals for 2019. I have a list of books I want to read and books for book clubs, but I want to make progress on two specific goals I have. Reading the classics and a focus on authors where I pick one author per month to try and read multiple works by that author. I am starting with Zadie Smith in January because I have never read anything by her and I want to. Happy holidays, ladies. Look forward to hearing more from you in 2019. Well, thanks, Sarah, for writing in. Yeah,
I really like those goals. Like we mentioned in our book resolutions, we both kind of enjoy older books rather than brand new ones.
Yeah.
More classic novels. And I think the other one where she reads several works by the same author, that's interesting. I've never heard of anybody doing that. And I also really like that.
We've only read one author for the show twice, and that was James Baldwin. And I liked that a lot. It's nice because we can go back and listen to our thoughts about the first one, which is probably painful because it's it was like when we were first getting started and didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah.
But I did like doing that. It was about a year apart, but I remembered quite a bit about Go Tell It on the Mountain when I was reading If Beale Street Could Talk. So I think that's a cool project. And as far as Zadie Smith goes, we did read Swing Time sometime last year. So you can check out that episode for it. And I know that she has a website where she does her blogging. And so you can follow her along with her goals. It's thegreatmorrisonmigration.wordpress.com. Morrison with two R's. So yeah, we look forward to peeking in and see how you're doing with that. One more thing we had in response to our Little Women episode. Zach, who is your partner, Becca.
My life partner.
He called in because he noticed something in the episode. Let's just play what he has to say here.
So Corinne, you asked Becca what she looked for in a partner, and her answer was...
I mean, I'm going to say someone who is your intellectual equal and has the same interests as you. Wink, wink, Zach. Equal.
And I was thinking, that's a little too nice for what Becca normally does. But then I remembered.
Listen, I'm not that smart.
So I guess, yay, we're intellectual equals?
Do you have a response, Becca?
It's pretty funny, and I didn't know he was doing that, which makes it even more funny. And also brings it back to, what did you say a long time ago about you find out how stupid you sound when you start recording everything you say or something like that?
Yeah.
And I feel like that. I don't know how many contradictions or weird things that I have said, but this is just one of many, I'm sure.
Thanks for calling in, Zach. We are glad to have you as our intellectual equal.
Yes, very much.
Well, let's start talking about the book we read this week. What was it?
The Transit of Venus is Shirley Hazard's third novel. Hazard was an Australian-American writer. She won the National Book Award for Fiction for her novel The Great Fire, which came out after The Transit of Venus. And The Transit of Venus was published in 1980 by Viking Books, which is now owned by Penguin. So that's who now publishes The Transit of Venus. This is the best that I can do. The novel introduces us to two Australian sisters, Caroline, or Caro, and Grace. They are raised by their half-sister Dora following their parents drowning when their ship, Benbow, goes down. Eventually, the sisters all move to the UK, where Caro and Grace get jobs. Grace gets engaged to Christian Thrale, moving in with his family and bringing Caro along. While living at the Thrales, Caro meets Ted Tice, who falls in love with her and remains in love with her for the entire novel. She also has an affair with Paul Ivory, a playwright and son of a poet, who becomes engaged to and marries the Thrales' neighbor, Tertia. I feel like there's a lot of hard words in there.
Yeah, Thrale, their names are is not an easy to say. Thrale, yeah. Sounds so, I mean, it just doesn't roll off my tongue very well.
So, in the novel, we have several characters, although Caro is definitely the main one. She's possibly written as a manic pixie dream girl, especially to Ted Tice. She works as an assistant, eventually marrying Adam Vale, a very wealthy American, and moves to New York with him. Before her marriage, she has an on and off again affair with Paul Ivory. And then we have her sister Grace, who is timid and average next to Caro. She marries Christian Thrale, has a few kids, and sustains a very average domestic life until her son gets sick and she meets his doctor. And I guess I would say contemplates having an affair with the doctor. Then we have Dora, who is Caro and Grace's older sister. She raises them after their parents drowned. I would say Dora probably has a narcissistic personality disorder. Being armchair psychologist here, she's definitely emotionally manipulative to the sisters. She loses, I think, all of her money after her husband takes off and leaves her. And Adam Vale supports her because he is wealthy for reasons. Christian Thrale is Grace's husband. He's very boring and predictably has an affair with his secretary. Paul Ivory, he is at first an aspiring playwright, then gets his plays performed regularly. He marries Tertia for her wealth and status, but has a secret. And Ted Tice, he lives at the Thrales in order to be a student of Sefton Thrale, who's Christian's father. He's madly in love with Caro. He marries another woman and has children, but keeps the flame alive for Caro always. He becomes, I guess, a famous scientist. Astronomer. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. It is called Transit of Venus, after all, so.
Yeah. And then rounding out the men, we have Adam Vale. He's a rich philanthropist. He has a daughter, Josie, from a previous marriage that ended when his wife committed suicide. He also has a sister, Una.
Yeah, so that's a lot of people. And it's hard to, like, figure out who to include because this book is insane. But before we start with that, I want to talk specifically about my copy of it. I have a mass market paperbound copy from, like, let's see exactly when it was published. This was printed in 1981, so a year after the book was first released. And it is by Playboy Paperbacks, and I can find no info. I mean, I assume it must be, like, the Playboy, but I can't find any information on it as, like, a publishing house or even an imprint. But it's interesting. And it's actually got a pretty gorgeous, like, illustration on the front cover of a woman with, like, cold shoulder top on. And and then on the inside, like, when you open it up, there's, like, a two-page, like, the cover spread. The inside of the cover and then the other side has, like, all of the, like, very 1980s. Like, it reminds me of the Thornbirds for some reason, illustration across it. So I kind of loved this copy specifically.
I'm interested to see when mine was published, because mine has, like, the classic orange and white penguin spine.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this is 1990 is my copy. Okay.
Anyway, what was this book?
What was this book about?
I'm not sure I'm smart enough for this book.
Right. Me neither. Is it about astronomy? There's some things about astronomy.
Is it about a pair of orphaned sisters? We don't know.
There's something about a telescope that, to be honest, like, bored me so much I kind of skipped over it. I know I shouldn't do that, but I just Ted Tice was like talking about how it's the wrong place for the telescope.
Yeah, they want to put a telescope in England, which is like, you know, notoriously rainy and cloudy. And he's like, can't do that here. Got to put it somewhere else. And he dissents the opinion of the rest of the English scientists. It's really like not, I would say not important. Probably, because like right. None of their jobs seem important, even though you end up kind of in the middle of them trying to figure out what they're doing. Like Adam Vale, you know, like he just shows up and they're seeming like he works at the office where Carol works in the government, and who knows what she does. I don't know.
Makes sandwiches.
Yeah. Everything that I thought I could grasp onto to like have a hold and figure out what the plot of the story was just kind of like slipped away, or there weren't enough details for it, but there were so many details for other things.
Well, and there's moments where I think something's going to be really important or someone's going to be really important and they're just not, like Christian's father, Sefton Thrale. Yeah. It's like the beginning is in his house because the girls are, the sisters are staying there,
right.
And he's and doing so this Ted whole Tice. Thing,
yeah.
Right, and he's doing this whole thing with the telescope, and then he's just gone, and mm-hmm. he doesn't matter at all.
It left me feeling like I was falling all of the time, and it was very frustrating for many reasons. But that being said, like, the writing was very beautiful.
Yes.
So what did you think about that? Like, I know it's kind of hard because sometimes I say, like, you can't say the writing is good if the story wasn't, because the story is in writing, but I am often wrong about that opinion too. But
yeah, it was kind of confusing to read this because I really didn't know what was going on most of the time. But then I would come across sentences like this, which is near the beginning of the book, something Kara was thinking. This man was no more to her than a callow ginger presence in a cable stitch cardigan. Now, I don't even know if I know what she's talking about, but it just sounds so nice.
Yeah.
It just sounds so good. Like, the writing is just such a weird kind of descriptive writing.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, there's a big emphasis on beauty, like, physical beauty mm-hmm. and beauty in, like, surroundings and stuff, which, I mean, you could pretty much pick out any sentence or, like, any paragraph and find something that's just, like, a very beautiful description, which I probably should have, like, marked some shit out for. But of course, the only time I ever marked anything was when I was like, what the hell is happening here? Anyway, we'll move on from there. But yes,
yeah,
the writing, while like very beautiful and descriptive, sometimes just left me like, wait, but what? I don't know if I understood a lot of it, but it was the second book we've read for this podcast project in which the word crepuscular is used. So
there was like, I don't know how to, there's like a lot being said where at the same time, nothing's really being said.
Yeah, it's a lot of words to describe, like, the color of a coat, which often yes. was just dun colored. I need to find out what dun is.
I always, you know, I don't know either, but I always think of it as, like, tan.
Yeah, that's what I assume. Dull grayish brown color. I was thinking, like, the color okay. of, like, a cottontail rabbit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or like a deer.
Right.
It was just very weird for me because I would read it and I would really enjoy the writing. But then once I stopped to think, so what happened in that paragraph? What happened in that chapter? I just am not sure.
Yep. I don't know. Like, there's not much else to add. Yeah.
Well, and there, it also kind of threw me because there's things that happen. Like, for example, Ted Tice living with the Thrales, Grace and Carol living with the Thrales, Tertia living in a castle that it didn't, it said, I believe it starts in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And goes till what, the 70s, I think?
I would say probably the late 70s. Also thought, like, probably right up to basically publication, based on something that happens right at the end, which I don't know,
yeah.
we'll give away. Yeah. Oh, which, by the way, like, this is a book that's been around for, you know, obviously, like, 38 years, so there's been time to read it, but we know it is more obscure. We're going to try to keep it from being too spoilery, just in case you want to check it out. But if there is a huge plot spoiler, there is one big secret that we might want to talk about, but we'll give you a fair warning for when that's going to happen. So you can skip ahead if you plan on checking the book out at all.
So the writing and the style and what people do and how people interact with each other didn't strike me as 1950s. I mean, just the fact that somebody would like stay in somebody's house for months on end doesn't feel modern. It really, like, I had to remind myself this is 1950s, not 1850s, because it felt a little old-fashioned in some
points. And it's hard to say like how much of that is just like partially like English aristocracy, and I don't know if it's,
that's true.
I don't know if the Thrales were necessarily aristocrats, but they did live like, I think Tertius' family was, and so like it is definitely at least upper class, so a lot of things are very formal. Christian Thrale is a diplomat, at least, so he's working in the government. I think there's still some vestiges of that, and I think, in general, I don't necessarily understand the way that class works in England. I know it's different than here, obviously, mm-hmm. So I think maybe that's part of why it just feels, like, strange to me. But yeah, I agree, it does feel old-fashioned a little bit, and I think, like, her language does that too. It's technical and it's a little difficult, even though it is very beautiful to read. The parts that I really liked is that Hazard has some like really great observations about people's behavior and the differences between sexes, I think, a lot. So what did you think about that kind of aspect of it?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think some of the best parts come in when Paul is like thinking about Caro.
Yeah.
Not that it shows him in a good light. It's kind of horrible. But it just kind of feels like, how do I say this? I don't know. Like, not many authors make these kind of observations about men who are having an affair with a beautiful girl kind of thing.
I also found, I don't know if it was like super alarming to me just because of like the time in which I'm reading this and being very aware of this stuff, but the way that Ted Tice is like obsessed with Caro too is just kind of terrifying. There's a part where he spots her, he starts following her. The quote is, "When in the street he had her in view, he held back an imaginary relish of the sweetness of it. Stalking her, he knew an assurance of happiness such as he had seldom felt as an adult, and which was incompatible with childhood." Oh, I'm wrong. This is a different part. This is when Christian is stalking his, this is when Christian is following
the
his
secretary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, the point still
stands. I think it can
stands.
Also apply, to Ted Tice, but, Christian had been in love as a lad and then as a young man, ready to take a wife, but not as now, when quite out of any context, representing no forces other than those beyond his control, he watched Cordelia Ware in a frenzy of tenderness confused between worship and condescension. And I think that last part, confused between worship and condescension, is like such a good like summary of the way that like all of the men in this book function. There's mm-hmm. this feeling of like admiration and loving women, but also like owning them and thinking they're less than you. And it comes across, even though I had the characters confused, it comes across in all of them. Like Ted is kind of the same way. Paul is definitely the same way. Christian is probably the worst at it because he loves to be smarter and more good and better with money than all of the women. And he loves to lord that over them. And it's just, I felt like it was so spot on to the way that I, like some men that I know who treat women poorly. It was mm-hmm. very, very apt.
It's also just like very honest when you think of like, you know, with Christian and with Paul, how they're both married or Paul is engaged and they're still having an affair with somebody else. That a lot of times I think in books when that kind of thing happens, it's like, oh, the man though, he needs something new to refresh him and he deserves this. And I think Hazard really kind of shows what the men are thinking and feeling without being sympathetic to them. So we also kind of see how they really are. Because I was like, there's another part that's really similar to what you read with Paul. He's with Caro. And he says, "My God," complaining like the classic mistress. He knew she would never hold out against the suggestion that she might begin to get on his nerves. He had no wish that she should be secure in his love and might have held it was reoccurring loss that bound them. that part where he had no wish that she should be secure in his love is just like so awful, because what you should want if you love somebody and they love you is for them to be secure.
Right.
And I think it's just, you know, so true that a lot of men, or maybe people in general, don't think that they want somebody to be insecure.
Yeah. And I mean, feminist is obviously like a word that gets thrown around a lot. But what I loved about this writing and these specific observations were that sometimes they literally like made me shudder with like the truthfulness of it, without it being like I was being smashed over the head with the unfairness. You know, it was just kind of like devastatingly true and just very uncomfortable, because like either I know men who have acted in such a way, or just like the inequity of the like the power dynamics when, for example, Grace confronts, or doesn't really confront, but she has a confession kind of experience with the doctor who she's in love with, which by the way, his name is Angus Dance.
Which is so good. Crazy. These names.
Such a crazy name. And he, you know, is just like, well, I'm taking a new job. And she's kind of struck with how she's always been stuck in the same spot, and how men have so many more options and opportunities than she does, because her husband had also just gotten a promotion. And he's like, well, I can't go on doing the same thing with my life forever. And she's like, well, I can, because I have to and I've been forced to. So why can't? You know, and it was just very devastating, I think. Some of it was so great. It's so crazy how when I was done reading this book, I looked back and like as I kind of tried to fit pieces together, because there was so little to grab onto as I was reading it, I liked it so much more than when I was reading it. I was so impossibly frustrated.
Well, speaking of something that I can say that I still don't like about it is the character of Caro.
Oh, yeah.
We just talked about all these things, all these observations Hazard makes about other people. But when it comes to Caro, I feel like I know almost nothing about her.
Yeah. I don't know what she likes. She doesn't have a personality. And sometimes she just is like outright bizarre. Which
what
I
is
mean,
that part that you brought up where she like is ironing the belt?
Yes. So there's a part where they're going to have an engagement party for Paul and Tertia. And for some reason, Tertia is at the house, and like there's a room in the back where the women iron their clothes and get ready and dressed and stuff. So it says, oh, that's why she says in deep water. Whatever. Okay, so Tertia brings in some flowers, I guess, and she says they must go in deep water. And she lays them down. And then Caro is ironing, and she's just standing there watching Caro. So Caro sets the iron down on its rest and held up the belt, her head back, her arms raised, and the belt suspended. Being human, she could not help herself. Oh, what does that mean? she knew she had sometimes left her mark, but on this occasion had a taste to see the fact acknowledged. I guess she's just trying to play against Tertia. I'm not really sure. Like there's some sort of like silent feud going on here. But anyway, Tertia says, and what are you going to wear, or what are you going to put on tonight? And then it says, Caro continued to hold up the belt to one side like an abstracted snake charmer so she could look Tertia in the face. It was a pity there was no one else to see Caro then in her beautiful dress, her throat and arm bare, her delicate raised hand and her dark eyes fixed on their object. In this way, for some moments, she compelled Tertia Darge to admire. And then somebody calls her name from the garden, and she pauses, goes about it, puts, there's a whole bunch of more stuff. She carries a vase around, and she puts the flowers in water, and then she says, in deep water, and just leaves. It's just, like, it's such... It's kind of like what so many of the conversations in this book are like. I think now, having read everything and then going back and rereading it, I can feel like the tension and see what's happening. But there's so much to read between the lines, but you can't know what is there until the book is over, like to read it. That's a really weird experience.
I just felt like I was missing so much about Caro. while I was reading it. I don't even really know what she looks like. She has dark hair and dark eyes, but she alternates. And I think maybe this is just like a function of like a older style language, but she is referred to as like being dark or the dark one.
Yeah.
Which I assume to mean like dark coloring. I don't know if that's the correct word to use.
Well, like maybe like olive-toned skin or something.
Yes, yes. But then she's also called pale.
Yeah, and sometimes like it'll say that she's beautiful and soft, and then other times it'll say that she is gaunt and she has huge eyes, and she just sounds crazy to me.
And all the men are in love with her. When she eventually, we only really know about Ted Tice and Paul Ivory, but when she marries Adam Vale, it's mentioned that she gets a bunch of letters from a bunch of men congratulating her kind of thing who are in love with her. I just don't really know why, because she's pretty silent most of the time. And I guess I get the feeling that that's what I'm supposed to think intrigues men, that she's silent and mysterious.
Yeah, which is why, like you said, it does kind of have that manic pixie dream girl quality to it, because you can sort of see how like these people are projecting their feelings onto her, which I guess is maybe interesting, but also it's not.
So. I mean, it would be if we got any sense of who she really was, right? I think. But we just don't get that.
Yeah, she just stays kind of empty.
As you mentioned, there's a specific chapter on Grace, and then there's a chapter, really short one, about Valda, who is Caro's coworker, and it's a really, really great chapter. Has nothing to do with the rest of the book, but in that chapter, I learned so much about Valda and who she is.
More, yeah, I feel like I know Valda more than I know Caro.
Then adding to the confusion, when Caro goes to her boss to turn in her notice, he like mentions something that she's like Valda or something like that.
Yeah.
Or for her not to be like her. But we got no indication that Caro agrees with Valda, wants anything to do with Valda.
I mean, in the same way, like, I don't know what would attract Caro to Paul Ivory, except for that he was handsome and dressed well. I don't see why he would be any more of an attractive mate than Ted Tice, who up until, you know, later in the book when we find out how kind of creepy and stalkery Ted Tice is, like, at that point, seems like a very good person who just has, like, a sciencey job. And he's nice because they, like, go visit some manor house or something together one day. And it seems like they have a nice day.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't get any of that background on Paul until the very end. And then you see, you know, how Paul kind of like pulled the strings the whole time. It's just very strange because we get long histories for both Paul or for both Ted Tice and Caro in the beginning. And then so much of the book is focused on Caro's like and how her life kind of revolves around Paul. But that history doesn't come for Paul until much, much later. It's a weird sort of structure for that. It's funny, like, the way that the information is withheld about some of the characters. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's why I wouldn't mind Caro turning or rejecting Ted Tice, even though he seems like a pretty good guy to go for.
Yeah, I mean,
Paul.
I was fine with her rejecting him.
If but, there was a reason for it, it just doesn't make any sense. She's really, like, attached to Paul. To the point where he treats her like shit right to her face.
Yeah.
And she still is with him. And then it just, I guess that kind of confuses me too, because in some ways, especially with what Christian thinks of Caro, she seems more like an independent person, supposedly, you know.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to Paul, she's like, I don't see that at all in her.
You know what I'm thinking about right now? And we talked about how bizarrely she acts. One thing is when she and Paul Ivory sleep together for the first time, Tertia drives up in a car to pick up Paul, and like he's leaning out the window with his shirt on. He's not dressed from the waist down. And he's trying to pretend everything is fine and like stall Tertia a little bit. But even though I think Tertia knows what's going on too. And then suddenly Caro just stands up from the bed naked and comes to the window so that Tertia can see her and see what Paul has been up to in there. And I just feel like I'm never given a clear picture of what would like that would be something in her character. because, you know, she's so deferential to, like, Dora, who is the only other person we really see her interact with, like, a whole lot, that it seems very crazy that she would just get up and act so brazen with this other woman who's marrying a man that she kind of barely knows. It's very weird.
Well, yeah, and I just don't know what, I mean, what was her goal in that?
Right.
To show
a power
up
move,
Tersha?
Yeah.
And it just seems kind of odd because I definitely see how the book is positioning the two of them as rivals, but I also don't see it because Tersha seems kind of like a little bit of an annoying rich girl. But does she...
Well, Tersha's also cheating on Paul Ivory with that other guy.
Yeah. I mean, does it is it really that? Like, I mean, Paul is the one who is, like, his idea was to marry Tersha.
Yeah.
So it just seems kind of odd that Caro is like, oh, like, am I supposed to think that Tersha is taking Paul away from Caro? Because I'm not getting that sense.
It's a weird... book. And it's funny because so many of the reviews of this book, like, they're just glowing. People love this. They think it's a masterpiece. They think it's incredibly constructed, which, I mean, I get it to some extent. I do think the writing is incredible. I'm surprised I hadn't really heard that much of Shirley Hazard before, based on, you know, just her craft, like the sentence crafting and everything else she does, but in imagery. But yeah, the construction of this novel is very confusing to me. And even the character interactions is confusing to me. I don't know that I would buy this kind of scenario playing out in real life.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not the point.
Speaking of odd, like, novel construction, we mentioned already the chapter on Valda, Carol's random coworker who shows up. There's also a chapter just on Christian Thrale having an affair with his secretary. I also thought that was really well written. I don't know. It was just interesting to see, like, you knew what was going to happen because this kind of thing happens. Like, it's there's plenty of books written about stuff like this.
Kind
plenty
of textbook.
Yeah. But it was just kind of interesting to see it from that angle, I guess. What did you think of that chapter? Or was it two chapters?
Well, I can't remember. I found it disturbing again because you're getting this, like, I guess I wouldn't necessarily call it grooming, but you're getting, like, all of the calculated choices he's making in order to get her put in this position to kind of, like, go out with him and say yes. And I think, you know, she was willing and consenting to it, so it's not, like, super manipulative, except for that he is her boss, technically. But, like, the way he kind of orchestrated the whole situation to make her stay late, and then he would offer to drive her home, and the way that he got his wife to stay away for two more weeks so he could continue to try to put the moves on this woman was just very creepy to me. Just, like, get something better to do with your life.
It's creepy and pathetic.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it really, yes, he was in the position of power, and yes, he had all the power, and I definitely question whether Cordelia could have said no or not and what the outcome would have been if she rejected him. But it also just, he's just such a pathetic, stupid creep, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I there was another line, and I wish I would have marked it. It's when, you know, Caro saves up a lot of her salary in order to pay Dora back because I guess Dora has guilt-tripped them into believing that they need to, you know, like, give her something for all of the struggles she had raising them. And that really rubs Christian the wrong way because he's mad that they're giving their money to her. And he thinks it's a waste of money, which it is, because Dora's always going to have something to ask for. But the way he lords that over Caro specifically is very disturbing to me, too, because he loves feeling superior to her specifically. And so it is really interesting the way that, like, all of these different men have obsessions with her in a certain way. It showed him to be just so pathetic. I think he even said something like he liked her less because he couldn't feel superior to her anymore. And that was just, like, such a, ugh, again, just, like, sent a shiver down my spine.
And then on the opposite end of an affair is his wife, Grace, wanting to have an affair with her son's doctor. Their son, Rufus? Is that his name?
Rupert.
I can't remember. Rupert. He gets sick. I already forgot why.
He had a back thing.
That's right.
And they gave him surgery. Right. So I think it's scoliosis. Rupert and I are buddies in that respect. Because I think they do. They put a rod in his back. So
okay.
Just like me.
Did you have a hot doctor too?
So my dad's cousin is a nurse and she loved him. She did think he was hot, but I was 13 and was creeped out by like anybody being around my body too much. I'm still, but yeah.
Grace meets Angus Dance, as we said, because her son has to have surgery. And I thought that was such an interesting look at, again, her as sort of a bored housewife, because one of the parts she talks about talking to the doctor and realizing that she's never actually had conversations like this with anyone else, not even Caro, who she thought she was close to. And that just sort of, it broke my heart. And I also thought it was just really smart observation, like Grace's model housewife and mother. Mm-hmm. And yet she still realizes that she's missing something huge.
Yeah, that chapter was, again, another... She, up until that point in the book, she's really a minor character. And then that chapter comes along and kind of blindsides you and makes you realize, again, that you still don't know anything about Caro. I guess, I don't know, like Grace, you don't know anything about her. But yeah, that was just... such a bummer too. And she seems like good human being, so it's a bummer that she's married to such a pathetic jerk. You know, she can love her children and still want so much more for her life. It was just, yeah, I don't know, it was touching and it was beautifully written.
I actually thought when I first started reading that Grace was going to be the main character, because I seem to remember her being described as like very shapely and beautiful,
right?
And Caro is like got kind of long stringy hair, but then it kind of flips.
Coarse hair, so that's thick, that's gaunt and chubby but also gaunt. But
and then Ted Tice has a scar on his his eyeball.
I have no idea.
Because the way it's first described is I thought that it was just like some kind of like imperfection of his eyeball, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it sounded,
but then people are noticing it.
To me, I started thinking of it as like a scar that went like across his eye, so like his eyebrow and then like below his eye. Maybe his eyelid was affected, but then sometimes it did sound like it was his eyeball, and so I have no idea.
That's what I was wondering too, because people would like think about, I think Paul thought about it as in like, oh, he's perfectly fine looking except for that huge scar on his eye. And I'm like, oh, okay, this isn't just like a weird thing on his actual eyeball, it's like crossing his face or something like
that. They did make it seem like it was some kind of like VC Andrews type weird defect, when it was really probably just like a normal run-of-the-mill scar on a person's face. But whatever.
Do we want to share a little spoiler here?
Yeah, let's do that, because I think, so we are going to spoil a huge kind of plot twist, and if you don't want to know about it, you can skip forward. I'll drop in how many minutes when I'm editing. I think we kind of have to do it, because it was a different time, but also I think it is kind of an important piece to mention.
If you wish to miss major spoilers, skip ahead 4 minutes and 20 seconds. See you later.
So, like, the big turn in the plot is they're much older and Adam Vale has died and Caro is living in New York, and she runs into Paul Ivory, whose son is, I don't know, probably in his 20s now. Time, what is time in this book? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And his son is described as having leukemia, and then he says that his son is also homosexual. And I'm thinking, because of the time period that it is, that his son might actually have HIV or AIDS, is my guess, because they used to call it the gay cancer.
Yeah.
And when I read that, like, my heart just sank. I was like, oh, this is awful, and it's going to bring Paul down to earth, you know? Mm-hmm. But instead, he uses that opportunity to confess that he basically, like, murdered somebody by negligence and then orchestrated this entire situation and pulled all the strings to it that kind of shaped Caro's life. And it is bonkers.
Yeah, he is involved with this guy who's extorting the guy, and the guy's dad are extorting Paul for money.
Well, yes, because we also find out that Paul is a gay or bisexual, but you know, he has at least had relationships with men, I guess, is where we are. Yeah,
which, just as a real quick aside, it's it did make me uncomfortable the way the one non-straight character was portrayed as pretty much evil. A horrible person.
Yeah.
Evil. Yeah. Evil. Yeah. Not great. But anyway, so he is on the bank of this river and he's with his lover. The lover's sleeping, I guess, on the ground. Yeah. And then Ted Tice walks by and he sees them. And then later on,
and this is Ted, this is Ted walking to the Thrales house, or no, walking to the train station to take to the Thrales or something.
Yeah. And then Paul walks away and he finds out that the river is going to be flooded because they're going to release the current water or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a dike that's not going to hold, basically.
And instead of saying anything, he just lets it happen so that his lover will drown.
Yeah.
And so Ted knows this because he saw them. He saw the guy sleeping. So he realizes what Paul did. But Ted doesn't do anything. He doesn't say anything to anybody.
Ever.
So then Paul, when Paul and Ted are both at the Thrales, he realizes that Ted is in love with Caro, he seduces Caro to get back at Ted for knowing something about him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it does put a different spin on it because there's a lot of observations that Paul makes about Caro that now knowing that he was not really in love with her just kind of don't make sense.
Right. And it does. I mean, it makes a lot of things make sense, too. Like one of the first lines in the book is that there was a body that would be found when the bridge washed out. And then there is a point also, which I thought was very strange when I first read it, that within the first chapter says that Ted Tice is going to die by suicide many years from now in a northern city or something. And I think it's interesting because you definitely have to go back and like remember all of these little pieces that didn't make a lot of sense. And then suddenly they come together. But the way that they come together is just like very off the wall. So
yeah, and it does explain why Paul married Tertia, because and why Tertia stayed with Paul even though she knew he was cheating on her with Caro.
Yeah, is, I mean, because she didn't with care him having relationships with men. Yeah, and yeah,
that was their like agreement. So that does explain a little bit too. But overall, it just felt like this was supposed to be a big reveal, and I was just sort of like, okay.
I finished it at like 1 o'clock this morning, and I wanted to text you immediately going, what did I just read? Because it's so wild, and it does, like, in a way, I don't know, like, maybe that is supposed to be clever or something, but I in a way I do just end up kind of feeling like duped by it. I don't know, there's something about twists that are just kind of cheap to me a little bit. Mm-hmm. Especially this one where like it's all explained in exposition and there are breadcrumbs along the way, but it's not ever something that you're gonna like piece together for yourself. So it's strange.
Yeah, it felt like, to me, like a Agatha Christie or some other kind of detective novel where at the end, the detective or investigator just explains everything to everyone assembled and present. Like, right. This is the crime and this who did it. And that's how it kind of felt. So yeah. It just didn't feel very, what do I want to say? Very elegant. Like, there's a lot of elegant writing, and then leading up to it is just this big chunk of stuff.
Yeah. We won't spoil the very, very ending. Should we do final thoughts?
Talking about it does remind me of all the stuff that I did like about it. And because of that, I actually would be willing to read more Shirley Hazard because I genuinely like her writing.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'll reread this book. I know rereading it, knowing the twist, would change how I'm reading it, but I just don't think it would be worth it. I just don't think the twist was good enough for me, right. I guess.
There was a quote that I read in one of the reviews, or somebody paraphrasing a story about Shirley Hazard's husband. I think he was a Proust scholar or something like that. Mm-hmm. So she married a very literary man as well. He said that nobody should ever have to read Transit of Venus for the first time. And I do think that's that's like a very apt statement to make, because it is it's a crazy experience. Like, it's weird to think that the writing is beautiful but also be so frustrated by it, and then it's also weird to get to the end and then find yourself going, oh well, now there's so many things that could make sense if I went back and found them.
Yeah.
While I think that's, I don't know, a unique experience for a novel, I don't know if it's a good one. So I'm very conflicted about my feelings on this.
Yeah, I'm the same. It was 100% a unique reading experience. Yeah. It's probably the number one way I would describe it, is unique and full of coincidences.
Yeah.
People are often running into each other on the streets of London and New York. You know, just one of the two major cities in the world.
It's so wild. Like, Dora lives, like, you know, she moves from Australia to England and then lives in Portugal for a while and then moves to New Zealand with a friend and then back to Ireland. And it's like, these people are hopping continents. There's a point where Caro and Adam Vale are just like in South America for who knows why. So it's a weird book. I can't imagine like being able to travel the globe that much now, let alone, you know, 40 years ago, but who knows, maybe it was cheaper. Or maybe that's just exactly how much money these people have.
I mean, who knew that a playwright, Paul, and a astronomer, Ted, would be able to do so much international travel?
I know. Will you read her again? Would you recommend this book?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if I would recommend it. I would read another.
I don't know if I would recommend it. I don't know. I think if you are like very diehard literary fiction fan, it's probably worth a shot, because there are people out there who think this is like top of the top. And I think that that opinion is probably valid, and I just don't know enough in order to get there. But otherwise, you might skip on this one. I would probably read Shirley Hazard again, though. I will say that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think I would discourage somebody from reading it.
No.
But I wouldn't encourage it.
Yeah.
But
it's, this isn't something I'm going to go hand out to everybody who asks me for a book recommendation. That's for sure.
God, no.
Well, thanks for listening to The Bookstore.
We have a phone line and an email address if you ever want to talk to us about literally anything. The phone number is 616-730-1656. Be aware that we might play it on a future episode. And you can find all of our other contact information at thebookstorepodcast.com.
Our next book discussion will be The Wedding by Dorothy West. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
In the Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye.
I will be okay.